An open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Juan.
Hi, my name is Juan. I'm an alcoholic. And the Atlantic Group is my home group, and my sponsor is Jeff Parr. And my sober date is 7/18/86, and I'm working on 9, 10, 11, and 12. Wow. Little nervous. before I was, asked Sunday to share here, and, I felt really, really good about that, as soon as I was asked to speak, I started to think about what I was going to say. And I tell you, it hasn't stopped until a few minutes ago. I was outside talking to some people, and I related a story about how I identified with Forrest Gump. Actually, it wasn't Forrest Gump. It was a guy named Lieutenant Dan in the movie. And, just to make it, long story short, he goes out on this shrimping boat that Forrest Gump starts up. And, Lieutenant Dan, just for those of you who didn't see the movie, he was Gump's lieutenant, and he lost a leg, and he almost died, and Gump saved him in Vietnam. And we don't endorse any, and we don't talk about anything controversial, but I just want to tell you the story. And anyway, they're on this boat, and they go through a storm. They hang questionable shrimp. As a matter of fact, all the shrimping boats were wrecked. And then they go through the storm, and then finally, the seas quiet down, and they catch, a lot of shrimp. I'm talking about, miracle shrimp. And Lieutenant Dan, he, throughout this whole storm, and, with his leg cut off, he was in the storm rocking and rolling. And in the morning, after they catch the shrimp, everything is quiet, and he sits by the side of the boat, and he's looking out, and then he just jumps in. So Gump says, "Lieutenant Dan, where are you going?" And Lieutenant Dan just keeps on going, and Gump was telling the story to somebody while he was waiting for the bus, and what impressed me was that he said, "It looks like Lieutenant Dan finally made peace with himself, because he was very conflicted." And that speaks to me because my story, I drank, since I was very young, and alcohol, did a number on me, and I always felt scattered, and broken. And a lot of things, I had a lot of experiences, with alcohol, the worst experience was that when I was 12 years old, I took a drink, and I got in this car that belonged to my aunt, and I took the emergency brake off, and she was on a hill in Puerto Rico, and I started to roll in this car, and I almost killed six kids. And in Puerto Rico, they like machetes. Dad came out with a machete, and I started to run, but needless to say, it wasn't so funny at the time, but I didn't understand the consequences. That was the very first experience with alcohol. Then another experience with alcohol was when I was about 14, I was again in Puerto Rico, and I was by the side of a beach, and I was with a cousin of mine, and he was 17, and we were drinking Boone's Farm apple wine. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but... So we drank, and then we smoked, I passed out. And that was the end of it. And when I woke up, I just remember the sun blazing. And I remember that specifically because, I don't know, there was something cool about it, but I guess that was just a little preview of things to come, with the passing out. And those are two experiences that, stand out, and... we talk about in AA about sharing our experience, strength, and hope. I'm not going to linger too much on those experiences that I had with alcohol, but needless to say, that if I say I'm broken, then that covers all the bases, you know, and I used and abused everything that came my way, and I crossed a lot of lines, you know, a lot of things that I said I wouldn't do, I did, and I lost myself. I was completely lost, and I took a lot of prisoners, a lot of hostages, and that's all as far as experiences I'm going to say. But my strength, well, one major part of my story that I don't want to leave out is that I said I've been sober since 1986, and I came in the rooms, and, you know, I had a sponsor, and then he passed away, and I found it difficult, you know, making relationships to begin with when I first came in, and, you know, I never reached out again, you know, and I'd come to meetings, and I'd be like a tap dancer. I'd dance in, I'd say hello, and then I'd run. And I never really committed to a 12-step process, you know. But I got the first step, I think. I mean, you know, you know, since 1986, I got the first step, and probably the second and third step. But eventually, I stopped making meetings, and a lot of good things happened during that time, you know, I mean, a lot of externals, but I was still broken, you know, when I got those things, and it never worked out, you know, I had a marriage and it didn't work out, and eventually I started doing other things, you know, I was, you know, dry, and to me that means that, you know, I wasn't whole, you know, and I came to a meeting on 37th Street, and thank God for that meeting. It's called the Mustard Seed. And, you know, I was at the end of the rope. I really felt suicidal, and I asked for a person what my problem was, and they said I suffered from untreated alcoholism. And, you know, it really rang true with me. And eventually this person became my sponsor, and I went through all the steps, and I took every suggestion this person gave me, and I took some that I didn't want to take, like coming to this meeting, but I took it. And not because there's anything wrong with this meeting, but, you know, I had a lot of resistance, you know, and, you know, I'm glad that I met the sponsor, but I'm glad to AA as a whole and Bill Wilson, you know. But anyway, my life today, in 2 years, man, I tell you, it's amazing when you go through the process of the 12 steps, what happens. You know, I have felt extreme joy. And this is from a person that used to come in here and self-centered fear ruled me, you know. I never felt confident. I never felt comfortable in my own skin. And you could have told me, you know, like I've had friends and women tell me, you know, when I was younger, not now. You're not a bad-looking guy, you know, and you're pretty smart. I've had teachers say that, and I never, ever believed it. I like, oh, yeah, sure, you know. And today, you know, I don't toot my own horn and look for stuff like that, but I did something the other day that really made me see how far I've come along. I took my own picture on my cell phone, and with a big old happy smile, you know. And, you know, I did that because I could never look in the mirror and see a smile for many years, you know. And that's devastating when a person can't look at themselves, you know. And a lot of people here paved the way for me to be able to do that, you know. And I just want to say one thing, you know, on sponsorship. You know, sponsorship to me, I take it very seriously. And, you know, the example that's been given to me is something that I pass along, you know, and I'm just grateful that there are committed people in these rooms, you know, that, you know, aren't out to get something from you, you know, and aren't out to run your life. You know, they're just presenting the program of Alcoholics Anonymous the way it was presented to them. And I'm so grateful, you know, I am grateful, man. I live in gratitude, you know? And the last thing I want to say is, if you come here, give yourself that break, no matter what your head says, you know, no matter what your mind says. Don't listen to your mind, you know, listen to somebody else, you know, and, you know, maybe you two could have a happy face, you know, and that's what I hope for everybody. Thank you.
My name's Noreen Legault Mendoza, and I'm an alcoholic. That's a mouthful. I'm really excited to be here tonight. Peggy is my sponsor. I come here by way of the Pacific Group, and I guess I'm more nervous than I thought I'd be. I wasn't nervous till I stood up here. But what I want to tell you is that the only reason I'm alive today is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. If it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have died many times over the last few years. My last drink was on April 1st, 1985. I was born in Montreal. I grew up in Miami. An only child of a rowdy Irish mother and a fun-loving French-Canadian father, and there was a lot of parties, and there was a lot of love, and there was a lot of fighting, and there was a lot of upheaval, and there was a lot of alcoholism. And I knew to take, you know, I wanted to get away from the arguments, and when I drank alcohol, I could forget that. I had my first drink, I guess it was about 14. Actually, it was on my first, geographic. I had changed from one school to another because I had failed a grade, and my mom said, well, we didn't want the shame and the embarrassment of it, so let's go to this other school. And I had been invited to a party, and I had my first drink and my first kiss. And a lot of my drinking sort of followed suit from that first night, I have to say. At 19, I graduated high school, and I became a stewardess. And I was already drinking in the clubs while my girlfriends were going like to Pizza Palace and having beer in the back, you know, but I wanted to do it first class, so I was going to the lounges, you know, and I had fake IDs, and at one point, as a flight attendant, I had to have a police ID, you know, the airport ID, so I walked into the police station, and they said, well, how old are you? And I went, well, 21, and they said, okay, and they even figured out what year I had to be born in to put 21 in, so now I had a police ID that said I was 21. I was flying all around the country, and I had gone from drinking Boone's Farm and Valley High with my girlfriends to drinking scotch and soda with the fighter pilots. A lot of people say that they never had fun drinking. I can't say that. There were some good times. There were some wild adventures. There was a lot of parties. There was a lot of craziness that I just thought was great, you know, and I like that craziness. I like the manic behavior. I lived in, my first base that I had actually was here in New York City. And I would drink in the clubs all night long and throw on a uniform and then get on an airplane and fly off somewhere. And in thinking about what I was going to say tonight, it occurred to me that from the time I started flying from at 19 to the time I got sober at 35, if I wasn't on an airplane, there was a drink in my hand. Because what happens is, you would fly off somewhere, and then you would land somewhere, and then it was party time, you know, so the crew would go drinking, and then you'd get on the airplane, and you'd go home, and whatever day of the week it was your weekend, and this thing just always went on. Towards the end, I was even starting to drink on the airplane. I think that really brought me to the point of realizing that I was an alcoholic. In fact, the first time I heard I was an alcoholic, it was actually another flight attendant. And I was saying, God, I don't understand what's going on. I drink one glass of wine, and I'm all over the place. So she goes, well, maybe you're an alcoholic. And I looked at her like, you must be nuts, you know? So next time I saw her, I said, I found the answer. I'm really not an alcoholic. I have hypoglycemia. And she said, a lot of alcoholics have hypoglycemia. So I was just like, I was baffled with this whole idea of what this lady said to me. She is one of these people that got sober, I think, at 19 or something, you know. And at this point, I guess I was about 26. And I kept drinking and went through a divorce that really brought me to the edge. That was really when the drinking crossed over and became where I was drinking for survival, and the point that I couldn't live with whatever life was going on. I couldn't stand the pain. I moved at that point. There was a lot of geographics, and there's a few marriages. I tried to do all of that to stay sober, and that didn't work. At one point, I even thought if I joined the ladies' clubs, you know, like these little society ladies' clubs, that if I drank with them, I would be okay. And then I found out a mint julep is nothing but straight bourbon and mint leaves. When I finally got sick and tired and knew that I had to get sober, it was after a car accident. I had had a head-on crash where my only witness was this blind person. And my father took me to my first meeting. And I'll never forget, he had been struggling to get sober. I knew he was an alcoholic because my mother had been calling him an alcoholic my entire life. So how could I be an alcoholic if I wasn't sliding down the canal or falling out of the car or, you know, losing my driver's license or crashing the car? I hadn't done any of that, so I didn't think I was an alcoholic. But now I had a car crash on my record. So my father took me to this meeting, and I'll never forget. He stood up and he says, "Hello, my name is Renee, and my daughter is an alcoholic." I knew right away that was not the way you were supposed to do it. I don't know why. But I took it that he meant it with love. And my father and I ended up going to some meetings, and that was the most I ever heard him speak at any meeting. And it is my belief that I have gotten through the years that if you don't share at meetings, if you don't do service, if you don't do the steps, you won't really be sober. When I finally came into the rooms, I was so sick and so tired, as they said, I was willing to do anything. I had been 6 years going back and forth drinking. I would go to meetings drunk at early, like 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd hit the one bar so I could get to the 9:30 meeting, or I'd go to happy hour and then I'd go to a meeting, or I didn't want what you had. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want any of it. And I kept ending up in these meetings, and I don't know how. The only thing I can believe that it was divine intervention and the grace of God. I did not want to be sober. I was afraid all my life of not having fun. You know? So I got two sponsors. I went to women's meetings. I was in a very... I should say, but there was something that happened that was a blessing. I got hit in the head on the airplane, and I couldn't fly for a year. So that meant that I was able to get, you know, insurance and my workman's comp, so I didn't fly. So that meant I didn't have to worry about not being somewhere, because you have to understand, from the time I was 19, I had never slept in my bed all week long, you know, for an entire week. I had not a clue. I was 5 years sober before I could make a doctor's appointment. It was too much of a commitment for me. The first commitment I ever made for myself, I guess you would say, is Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was after my second divorce or somewhere in there. But I wanted to be sober. I became willing to do anything they said. If they would have said stand on my head, I would have stand on my head. I went through situations that I wanted to drink. I had gotten battered by a security guard at Eastern Airlines, and they tried to get rid of me and fire me. And I felt, what good is it being a sober woman if they can do this and bring out my past and everything else? But with the courage of the other women in Alcoholics Anonymous, I stayed sober. And I started working the steps. And things got good. I ended up going to NYU. I graduated with honors, which was a miracle. I ended up going out to Los Angeles, which is where I got involved with the Pacific Group. When I first had been in LA, was back in the 80s. One of the times during that 6 years when I was going in and out and in and out, and I remember somebody saying, oh, come to the Pacific Group. It's a big meeting. And I said, well, how many is a big meeting? And they said, 500. I said, I'm not going to no 500 meeting, you know. So this time now, I've got the willingness. I've got the burning in my stomach wanting to get sober. And I said, well, how many, you know, is coming to this meeting? And they said, 1,200. I went to the meeting. I sat in the back, and I had a sponsor, Millie G., God bless her, who sent me to Peggy. She says, you get in the kitchen, you do service. And she kept me alive just by keeping me sober. She made me go to Clancy's Yard. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to play volleyball, and I, you know, was running out of quarters. For anybody that doesn't know, if you're cursed, you have to put a quarter in the pot. And my father called and he had cancer. And so I left Los Angeles. Millie didn't want me to leave Los Angeles, but I thought I needed to mend my family. And I did, and it was good. And things were going great until my husband decided he wanted to move to New York. I had left 10 years before. I didn't want any part of it. I had celebrated 18 years sobriety, and I was ready to drink. I called up Millie G, and I said, I'm on the edge. I want to have fun, and I'm not having fun. She told me to get to New York when I got here to call Millie G, to Peggy. And I don't know if it looked like that to Peggy, but it felt like to me that I was running in to find her like the Energizer Bunny because my life laid on the line. I know I have to put my program first before all else, before my work, before my marriage, before anything I do, because if I don't, I will die. And today I want to live. Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic, and I'm very grateful to be here at this meeting. I'm always grateful to be at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I, too, owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am standing here, able to see you, able to speak to you, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything I have, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't take any credit for being here, because this program has really saved my life, and that's why I'm here, and I love this program, and it's just wonderful to be here. I grew up in a family where there was no drinking, absolutely no drinking. I'm from South Carolina. My father was a Baptist preacher, what we call hard-shell Baptist, which is another word for conservative, very conservative, or orthodox. The mantra of his church went something like this: no smoking, no drinking, no card playing, no dancing. So that's how I grew up. Small town, everybody knew everybody, you know, an old lady across town could whip you behind, and you'd hope that the word wouldn't get home because you'd get another one. That's the way it was. My father had a favorite sermon for drunks. He hated drunks. And about twice a year, he would pull this sermon out. He'd preach this sermon for the drunkards in the congregation. Little did he know what was in store for his son. My father was also my school principal. So I went to church with him every Sunday, all day Sunday, you know, good old Baptist church. We start the Sunday school, you end with night service. And a couple of times at night during the week. And to school, of course, every day. And I might add, my mother taught school along with him. So I was well protected. My grandmother raised me, my mother's mother. She lived with us. And she was sort of the anchor for me. She was a big, bosomy woman, a good cook, and she loved me to death. I was her first grandson born on her birthday. I could do no wrong, right? So that's how I grew up. It was very strict, but the times were strict, the community was strict, and we didn't know it was strict. I mean, it was just the way it was, you know, and we weren't that different from anybody else, except that I was a preacher's son. And there was a lot of love. My parents were very busy people. They were sort of community activists. My father did a lot of pastoral counseling. There were always people in and out of the house. It was busy, busy. But my grandmother was sort of an anchor. I wasn't abused. We didn't have much, but we always had clean sheets on the bed, food on the table. And that was as much as anybody else had. And I like to tell that because this is such an equal opportunity disease. You know, it doesn't care if you're a preacher's son and if your father preached against booze and if there was no booze in the house. And if you were never abused and you weren't hungry or anything like that, you know, I got this disease, and I know a lot of other people like me who got it. It's non-discriminatory. It does not care where you come from, what color you are, how much money you have or don't have. Anybody can become a victim. And I did. Growing up the way I did, I'm a late bloomer as far as a lot of stories I've heard are concerned, because I was a young adult before I picked up my first drink, really before I went to my first bar. I'd never been to a bar before. But Bill tells us in chapter 5 that we were spiritually sick. And anything I say here is my experience with alcoholism and my experience with this program. I don't stand here as an icon laying down the law for AA or anything like that. It's just the experience of another drunk with this disease and with sobriety. Bill tells us we were spiritually sick. And this is in chapter 5. He's talking about doing the fourth step. And when we clear up spiritually, we clear up mentally and physically. And I didn't understand that for a long time, because with the first three steps, we usually do the physical, mental, and spiritual thing. But by the time we get to chapter 5, he says we were spiritually sick. And then we clear up spiritually, we clear up mentally and physically. And I can see that in myself as a child. I believe for me that I have always had this disease. I had the isms of the disease before the alcohol was poured on. When the alcohol was poured onto the isms, it blossomed out in full-fledged alcoholism for me. I look back at myself and recall that I was always a loner, really a loner. I was the sort of person who loved to be left alone. If you leave me alone, I'll be happy. I love to live inside my head. And I learned very early, if you learn how to people please, if you're a good kid, if you make good grades, if you're polite, you do all the things you're supposed to do, people will leave you alone. And I did just that. When I was old enough, I taught Sunday school. I sang in the choir. They tell me, you know, I helped old ladies across the street whether they wanted to go or not. I was a real little zealot, little sunbeam for Jesus, all over the place, you know. But I was happiest when I was left alone, when I could stay inside my head. Along with that, I was a fantasy person. In the deep sense of the word, I was a fantasy person. Now, fantasy is normal for kids. It's normal for anybody. But when you take fantasy into your adulthood and you live your life by it, you might have a little problem. And I was very much into fantasy, very, very much. Perfect setup for the alcohol when he came along. The other thing about me, the other ism that I could pinpoint, was that I was a liar from as far back as I can remember. Not in the ordinary sense of the word that I would tell you that that wall is about to cave in or something like that. No, I didn't tell that kind of lie. I was too good of a sunbeam for Jesus for that. I would tell you nothing. And that's the deepest lie. I would tell you nothing until you told me first. Then when you told me first, then I knew what to tell you. You see, that's manipulation. And I didn't even know the word then. I didn't know the word manipulation, but as far back as I can remember, I was cagey, I was manipulative. And it was very interesting. I wasn't abused, there was a lot of love, but something inside me was very mistrustful. I didn't trust people, I was cagey and manipulative. And that was before I ever picked up a drink. What happened to me was I, of course, went through school, yeah, of course, and went on to college, and I went to a college where my parents had gone, and it too was religious at that time, and it was like a transplant of home. And it wasn't until I got away from home in graduate school, which was a couple thousand miles away from home, that I was introduced to alcohol, and I'll never forget it. I had been there a year, I had done very well. I was the kind of person who could, you know, put a sandwich in my briefcase, go to the library, stay all day, no problem. Loved it. Loved reading, being alone. That was me, and I did quite well. And I remember these people came by and said, you know, you're antisocial. You don't go anywhere. You don't do anything. You don't talk to anybody. You're coming with us tonight. And and they didn't have to twist my arm. I kind of knew that something. I think I was ready, you know, ready for a little adventure. And they took me to my first bar, and it's like it was last night. I remember it. I remember the bluish haze, the cigarette smoke. I remember the tinkle of ice in the glasses. I remember the first drink. I remember that drink and what it did for me. And I drank everybody under the table that night. Nobody believed that I hadn't been drinking the whole time. And that, I found out later, is one of the probable symptoms of oncoming alcoholism, the ability to drink a lot and not get drunk. I didn't get drunk that night. I did black out. Another symptom, okay? I blacked out. People told me the next day what I did, what I said. And in those days, it was rah-rah-ha-ha. We were all young and crazy, so it didn't matter. What happened to me was I was alcoholic and didn't know it. I went into the teaching profession, which is what I was prepared for, and I drank my way out of the teaching profession. It's just that simple. Over a period of years, I was a drunk who didn't know it. And my story is a story of denial. I refused to look at the alcohol. I loved alcohol. Alcohol was just the only friend I remember in that bar. What it really did for me, it lifted me out of myself. It made me feel at home on this earth, at home in this universe. I had never felt secure around people. I had never felt at home around people. And that night, that first night in the bar, I felt at home. I loved everybody. I felt secure. And I was never to feel that again until I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, because, of course, we know it doesn't last with the booze. What happened to me was I started teaching on the college level. My last job was at a reform school on top of a mountain in Tennessee. It's still there. That's the downward progression of my teaching. I was a teacher. I think I tried to be a good teacher. I was very serious, but I was a drunk. And there's no teacher like a serious drunk teacher. Oh, my God. I was to be reckoned with. I was a drunk who had a lot of enablers, and as we know, the enablers are people who help us with the best of intentions kill ourselves, because they don't know what we have. We don't know what we have, and that was the case with me. Throughout my drinking, throughout my teaching career, I had people who wanted to save me, wanted to help me. You're a good teacher, we want to keep you, but you've got to do something about your drinking. I remember this Daryl Dean who called me into his office. He said, you know what's wrong with you? You're from South Carolina. And you drink that bourbon. You South Carolina people drink that. You've got to stop that. I have a drink every night before I go to bed. And I drink brandy. So I want you to get a good brandy, and that'll take care of things. Well, you know what happened. I got the bottle of brandy, and I drank it all that night. You know? What happened was the teaching, it went on like that until I got a terrible, terrible reputation in the teaching field, and finally wound up at this reform school that I was telling you about in Pikeville, Tennessee. That was before integration of schools, so all the inmates there were black. They were from, say, 12 to 19 or 20. At 21, they went to the pen to finish their time. And what I'm going to tell you is what was told to me. I don't remember any of this, but it will show you where my drinking had gone by that time. The secretaries in the outer office reported this. They said they heard my voice rising. The superintendent had called me in to talk to me about my drinking. He was an elderly man who liked me very much, one of my enablers, you know. And they said they heard my voice rising. And I was screaming at this man and talking about his family, whom I had never met, and cursing him out and telling him what he could do with his job. Now, I really needed that job badly. I really needed it because I was in debt and what have you. But I told him that I was his best teacher, that he didn't have any other teachers. He was lucky to have me. And how dare he say something to me about my drinking. And I told him what part of me he could kiss, and what color it was, and then I showed it to him. I did. The next morning, when I woke up, you know the feeling? You don't remember what you did, but you know you did it. I went in early that morning. I showered a long time, and I brushed my teeth 3 or 4 times, and I went in, and the principal, not the superintendent, but the principal called me in, and he said, why are you here? And I said, I work here. He said, no, you don't work here. You resigned yesterday, and your resignation was accepted. And I never forget the look in his face. He looked at me, and he said, you don't remember, do you? And I didn't remember until he told me what happened. What happened not long after that was I wound up in the nut house. In those days, that's where we went. We didn't have the detoxes and rehabs that we have now. Thank God we have them. They save a lot of lives. And I was a drunk, of course, and when I detoxed, I was a cut above the regular nuts. And, of course, I let them know it. And they loved me. They gave me the little jacket to put on, and they gave me the tray with the plastic cups, you know, with the pills. And we had tons of pills because the psychotropic drugs had just come out. It was after the war, and they were experimenting with them in nut houses and jails. So we had tons of pills. And I would take them around, one for you and one for me. And it was just great. I don't have a nut house horror story. It was delightful. It was wonderful. And I actually cried when they put me out. I really did. I did not want to leave. By that time, I knew my life was unmanageable. Not in those words, but I knew I couldn't cope. I had lost tons of jobs. I had lost a job at Tyco. It was just horrible, and I was glad to be locked away. Well, what happened was, my analysis was that I needed to change locations. I was going through a phase. People go through phases. Once you get a divorce from the family, cut the umbilical cord, change locations, you'll be all right. And I came to New York. And it's the same story. I don't need to tell you what happened here. I got good jobs here. I lost them. I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. I had no idea that I could not pick up the first drink. That when I picked up the drink, the phenomenon of craving set in, and I was forced to continue drinking. I didn't know that. I had to come here to learn that. What happened to me here in New York was that I became homeless. That was in the days before the word homeless had been coined. We were just bums. I hustled 42nd Street. The little sunbeam for Jesus was picking up cigarette butts and hustling and going anywhere with anybody to do anything as long as the drink was involved. And I don't want to forget that. I don't ever want to forget that, what this disease did to me. That was, of course, before Disney, when 42nd Street was 42nd Street. And I got chased off 42nd Street. I mean, that's how bad I was. I mean, and I wound up eventually at 83rd Street, which was the men's shelter at that time for all 5 boroughs. And it was filthy and dirty. And that's where the city sent you when you could not manage funds. And that's how my folder read, incapable of managing funds. And I drank on the Bowery for longer than I like to remember. And it was terrible. It was filthy. It was dirty. And that's where this disease had taken me. By that time, I was absolutely crazy. I had wine sores. I had lice. I was a shitty, pissy drunk. And I don't bite my tongue in saying that because this is a filthy, nasty, dirty disease. It's not cute. It's not nice. It kills people. And I never want to forget what it did for me. What happened was a beautiful woman, Helen Ware, who's passed on now, who became my first sponsor, was a sober woman in AA, a social worker on the Bower, and she told me her story. And she told me later, she said, honey, I always tell your story. She said, we don't need your philosophy. We just need your story because somebody will be able to identify with your story. And she told me her story, and that was something that no one had ever done before. I had been screamed at, I had been preached to, I had been yelled at, kicked out of places, cursed out. But no one had ever said to me, this is how I drank, this is what happened, this is what I did about it. And she got me to my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of God, I have not had to pick up a drink since that time. And this is my anniversary month too, Judy, September. My date is September 16th, 1968. it's a testimonial that this program works. That's why we get up here. That's why we have anniversaries. That's why we celebrate, to not only give thanks to God for this wonderful program, but to show other people that it does work. I was a very sick alcoholic when I came. My stock in trade had been my ability to read and remember what I read and reproduce it to give it back. All that was gone. I could not comprehend anything when I came here. I couldn't comprehend the slogans. And the love of people gathered around me and supported me, which I see in this room. I see that you do that here. We do that in all AA rooms. And they supported me and gathered around me. And that's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was supported by the fellowship until I was capable of understanding the program, which is the steps and traditions and the literature and those things. But people loved me into sobriety, and I will always be grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous for that. That, to me, is a manifestation of the higher power. I have never had a problem with the higher power. I know that it's by the grace of God that I'm here, and the grace of God is expressed in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no doubt about it. We are all spiritual people. I hear people say they have problems with spirituality. You're spiritual because you are here. We are spiritual, and one of the most spiritual acts an alcoholic can make is to put one foot in front of the other and go to a meeting. That is a spiritual act, because behind that act is a spiritual motivation, the motivation of this program. And I'm just thankful to be sober. I'll say a little bit about how it is now before I have to sit down. I learned very basic things on the Bowery, because we were very sick people there, and one of the things that I was told very early that's helped me these 36 years that I've been sober is to no strings attached sobriety. Keep it separate. That this disease we have does not care what we do or where we're from or anything like that. It lives a life of its own. And we have to keep our sobriety separate. It's separate from everything else. It has nothing to do with how much money I have, how much money I don't have, whether I get the person I want or don't get the person or the job I want or the praise I want. It has nothing. We call it no strings attached sobriety. There's no such thing as I'll stay sober if. And I was told if you stay sober 24 hours, all excuses go out the window. All excuses go out the window, because this is a day at a time program. And any drunk who stays sober 24 hours can stay sober 24 hours. If you stay sober one day, you can stay sober one day. So that's the fact. If we stay sober one day, you don't have to drink. And that was really my spiritual awakening in this program, when I realized I didn't have to drink. I was very sick. I didn't have a white light experience or anything like that. My revelation was gradual. I realized that I didn't have to drink, that this program could keep me sober a day at a time. And I keep it very simple. I've gone through the steps many times. I've gone through the steps with other people. But for my daily meditation, I do the first three steps. I remind myself that I am an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. Not Bowery unmanageable, not garbage can unmanageable, but unmanageable in terms of things we talk about in steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. Shortcomings, character defects, fear, gluttony, jealousy, envy, pride, those things. And those things do get better. Let me tell you, there are things now that used to make me frightened that don't frighten me anymore. So, it does get better. But I always say about character defects, they're like fingernails and hair. They keep growing. And we have to keep them cut, okay? And we keep them cut by doing what we're doing right here tonight, by making meetings and working this program to the best of our ability. That's why it's so important to keep coming to meetings. Second step, I've come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, because I'm crazy every day. I don't mind saying so. I'm an insane alcoholic. Because I believe this is a threefold disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. I believe it's incurable, and I believe it's progressive. And therefore, the mental part is right along there with the others. And in the times that we live now, the world is crazy anyway, so we don't have a corner on the crazy market. We just look at TV, we can't drink. And I think it's very important not to drink. I think the first step supports the other steps. If we pick up that drink, all the spirituality and everything else goes out the window. And finally, the beautiful third step you know, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. And I read that step for years and never saw the word care. Never saw the word care. Care means protection, that I am protected. I am protected in this meeting. I am protected in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am protected by the spirituality of this program, the care of God. And you know what I realized? I realized that that's what I was searching for all my life. You know, as a child, the reason I was manipulative, the reason I was so fearful, was that I really didn't believe I was cared for. That was all the love in the house. That was my grandmother. That was the clean sheets and the food and everything like that. But as a little alcoholic, budding alcoholic, I believed that I really had to earn it all. I believed that nobody wanted me just for me. That I had to make the good grades. That I had to be the good kid. That I had to be the people pleaser in order for anybody to want me. And this room, these rooms, Alcoholics Anonymous, was the first place I came and found unconditional love. As filthy and nasty and dirty and crazy as I was when I came in here, people gathered around me and said, keep coming, and they supported me, and they loved me until I was able to begin to love myself. I want to thank you for this meeting, and thank you for my sobriety.